And I think that sooner or later, you must conclude that you reach a point where you've got a sufficient amount of egg on your face from betting against the Bible. And quit doing that. Because every time new information is turned up through archaeology or any other source, it confirms what the Bible says and answers another one of these questions, some of which I don't know particularly the answer to today, but every time new information turns up, it answers another one. I have just come to the point where I trust the Bible more than the critic.
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast that you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this week's insightful message.
And again, good morning. How many of you share my experience that there are moments when some odd memory that you haven't thought about forever, circumstances bring it back and it comes to you in vivid detail despite the fact that it's just been apparently gone for a long, long time. That anybody besides me? Yeah. It happened to me this week as I was preparing for this sermon. For me, it was a long ago memory of my first grade year at the Eminence Consolidated School System, and it was a thing that I had not thought of for such a long time. But when it came back to me, it was extremely vivid and detailed. It was a cool spring morning, very much like this morning. It had rained recently. There were puddles, I remember. And they got all of us from the first five grades 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, out of the Eminence Consolidated Schools Elementary Department. That made about 130 of us, because it was a pretty small school system. And they took us outside and they gathered us in a big mob there at the northeast corner of the building, southeast corner of the parking lot. And they gave each of us a brown paper sack, a little bit bigger than a lunch sack, nowhere near as big as a grocery sack, somewhere in between those ranges. And I know that I had participated in Easter egg hunts before this time because I understood exactly what was going on, but I have no clear memory of any Easter egg hunts before this one. So they gathered us up there outside the school and they put us first graders in the front of the mob, which was thought to be adequate compensation for our little short legs. And while waiting for the command to go, I spied an egg. It was not as far from me as from here to those chairs. It was very close. I was in the front row and I was on this corner and it was just right there, standing upright in the bare dirt, right underneath the greenery of one of the little trimmed juniper bushes that passed for landscaping back in those days. And it was a beautiful egg. It was dyed a pretty pale green, and it had a little paper garland glued at the ends, slipped over the middle of the egg, and the garland had a line of little dancing bunnies. I was that close that I could observe these details, and I knew one thing for certain: that egg is mine. I am so close to it, nobody can possibly prevent me. That egg is mine. And then they blew the whistle and I took off like a bolt, and this fifth grader from the back of the pack passed me like I was standing still and scooped up my egg without even stopping. And while I was reaching for it, it disappeared down the gullet of his brown paper sack, and amid the thunder of sneakers, while I stood there frozen, the rest of the mob raced around the corner corner of the building toward the playground. By the time I recovered, it was hopeless. I darted behind them, looking here, looking there, but all of the eggs had been hidden with about the same degree of difficulty, and there were none left for me. By the time Mrs. Gentry came to find me, I was sitting on the merry-go-round, sulking, and I had long since blown up my paper bag and popped it in disgust. The only person more disgusted than me was Mrs. Gentry, because she had had to leave the combined first and second grade classes in someone else's care to come find me, wallowing in pity. It's amazing, the memories that stick with you. So after Jesus, disgusted by the miracle-oriented appetites of his home region folk, and that was why he healed the nobleman's son at a distance, invisible to the crowd 25 miles away. After all that, Jesus and his apostles return from Galilee to Jerusalem. And they arrive in Jerusalem at, again, one of the Jewish holiday feast seasons. The calendar makes it fairly likely that this was the Feast of Purim, where they celebrated the events of the Book of Esther and the sparing of the Jews from the big plot of Haman. And there's other reasons for which it is most likely that that was the feast. At this point, John begins to give a list of several of Jesus' miracles, each of which are associated with one specific Jewish holiday, and each of the miracles seems somehow appropriate to the holiday celebration with which they are associated. You, of course, end up with the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ on the Passover, and you can plainly see why that would be appropriate. On this first one, the healing of the man at the Pool of Bethesda, the Purim holiday celebrates the deliverance of the Jews from what appeared was going to be the last terrible fatal blow of a long stretch of ill circumstances and suffering. If you don't know how to hook that thought up with this story, you come see me. I'll help you connect the dots. I was better at that in elementary school than I was at running in the first grade. So I can probably help you with that. But Jesus and the apostles pass through the market area associated with the sheep gate and a pool that has five porches. The porches would have been more or less like what you would call picnic shelters, only we know now that they were built of stone. They probably had thatch roofs, but none of that thatch survives for us. That's a guess. But we know that these five porches were like big stone picnic shelters, and that they surrounded a pool. We also know now that it was the smaller of two pools, which is why when King Hezekiah built them in the Old Testament, you see that he called the big one the upper pool, which would lead you to think that the second one is the lower pool. The big pool, the upper one, was a reservoir providing water for the city, especially in times of danger. And the lower pool, though it is not mentioned in the Old Testament, we know it now, was a little shallow affair with steps leading down into it, kind of public bath. And first, it makes sense. You don't want everybody bathing in the reservoir. I get that, because that's where your drinking water is going to come from. But also, the reservoir pool was steep and deep. It was just a big, steep-sided pit carved down into the rock and not much good for people to get in unless you could swim really well and no wading and all of that. But when the upper pool filled up to the overflow point, the water was channeled through a tunnel carved down through the native limestone which came into the bottom of the lower pool. We know all this now. In this passage, John 5:1-17, it is one of the single most debated passages in the entirety of the New Testament. And the debates cover a lot of ground, but it begins with the pool itself. When modern Enlightenment thinking got its start back in the 17th century, nobody could find anything remotely resembling this proposed pool of Bethesda in or around Jerusalem. And the scholars of the day largely concluded that the gospel according to John was written by somebody much later who had no knowledge of first century Jerusalem and who was prone to just make stuff up for theological reasons. And that was probably what, not only what happened here, but since it happened here, happened all through the gospel according to John, it was all just made up stuff. Then in the 18th century, a German archaeologist by the name of Conrad Schnick found the remains of just such a pool. And then exactly the right place in Jerusalem. The problem was that it was under the thing that was built on top of that thing, covering up the thing that John had talked about. A couple more centuries passed, and finally somebody raised enough interest and money, and just about the time, as it turns out, just about the time of my unfortunate Easter egg hunt experience, they were digging that place all to pieces. And they dug down through an old Crusader temple and then through a Byzantine sanctuary after that to what had been a Roman temple dedicated to the god Asclepius, who the Romans said was the god of medicine and healing. And beside it was this little pool with the stairs and the five porches surrounding it. See, part of our problem is that we're idiots. And we often think that we know so much more than we do. And we don't. But that is not the end of the arguments. For instance, why would God do such an arbitrary thing as sending an angel down just occasionally to trouble the pool to make sick people compete? Elbow and jostle and push and trample to see who can get into the water first, because only that guy is going to get... Why would God do such a mean and arbitrary... That doesn't seem like a thing that God had ought to be doing. And people worry about that endlessly. And now that we know about the pool that we used to think didn't exist, we can understand why the waters would be troubled, because when the big pool overflows, it goes down through that shaft and comes up in the bottom of the old pool. And you can, well, sure, it would bubble and stir and be troubled. So why is anybody theorizing anything about some angel when you can identify an obvious mechanical reason for the troubling of the waters? And in the oldest versions that we have of John's gospel, the tail end of verse 3 and all of verse 4, and if you were paying attention when Jim was reading that, it was up on the screen behind you. In that section, the last few words of verse 3 and the whole of verse 4 were put in brackets. And the reason is because those words, the part about the angel and whoever gets in the water first, all that, is not in the oldest copies that we have of the gospel according to John. It's not uniformly present, that material, into verse 3, all of verse 4, in copies of John's gospel until about 800 years after the incident. So, obviously, these same critical scholars say, what happened is this: some scribe scribbled a further explanation over in the margin, and somehow over years and years of copying, that explanation in the margin just managed to get included in the text, and now it's in the text where it doesn't belong. So we don't have to take the whole thing seriously. Throw all those ideas out. That was just some scribe. Don't need to worry about that at all. When I think about that, and then I realized that verse 7 was always there. Verse 7 is in the very oldest copies of the Gospel of John that we have, the part where Jesus says to the man, "Are you wanting to be healed?" And the man says, "Well, yeah. But every time the water is troubled, some other slob who's a little less crippled beats me down there, and I've got nobody to help me, so how am I going to be healed?" That was always there. So the only thing you're adding in the material in verse 3 and 4 is the thing about the angel, if you're really going to worry about it all. Some of you will have footnotes in your Bible explaining that whole thing. And some of you may have the verse actually removed into verse 3, all of verse 4, and put down in the footnotes themselves explaining the whole thing. And maybe, as many commentators assert, we are supposed to understand that Jesus did not believe any power resided in the pool, that he knew that it was all superstition, and that John is only recording local legend, which Jesus knew wasn't true. Maybe. Here's what I will say to all the critics on all the issues. For a long time, you denied that the pool ever existed, but it turned up. And when it turned up, it happened to be attached to a Roman facility, because remember, they did occupy Jerusalem at the time of Christ. It happened to be attached to a Roman facility dedicated to medicine and healing. And it was part of Hezekiah's structure, even though it is not mentioned by name. You get the implication when he says the upper pool, that means there's going to be a lower pool, and we found it, and it confirmed what it said back there. And I think that sooner or later, you must conclude that you reach a point where you've got a sufficient amount of egg on your face from betting against the Bible, and quit doing that. Because every time new information is turned up through archaeology or any other source, it confirms what the Bible says and answers another one of these questions, some of which I don't know particularly the answer to today, but every time new information turns up, it answers another one. I have just come to the point where I trust the Bible more than the critics. And that said, I will leave the technical considerations behind. Jesus and company passed by the pool with the five porches, all the sick people hanging out waiting for the troubling of the water, and Jesus sees this lame man, and he knows, as Jesus would know such things, that the man has been in this condition for a long time, 38 years, as it turns out. He's been sick, and at least a lot of those years he's been hanging out around the pool waiting for his chance to be first in the water and never getting his chance. And Jesus says to the man, "Want to be healed?" And I'm thinking the man's first response is, "Duh! I mean, this is profound, buddy. What do you think I hang around this pool for? Of course I want to be healed, but I can never get there ahead of anyone else. I'm right by the pool, but I'm always left high and dry." See what I did there? It was better than that. That's probably about appropriate. And Jesus replies to the guy. He says to him, he says, "You poor kid, here's an Easter egg." No, I'm sorry, I'm mixing up my stories. Jesus says to the guy, "Well, the solution to your problem is obvious. Just pick up that bed of yours and walk." And again, I think about the first second and a half of mental process. "Oh, you're really on top of it, buddy. If I could walk, I wouldn't..." Hey, I can walk! And he picks up his bed. And he walks. And it says Jesus slips away, crowds, excitement, the whole thing. And the man doesn't even know the name or anything else about the guy who made him whole. But he takes his bed and he walks away. And the Jewish authorities are so impressed, so very impressed that this guy who has been lame for 38 years has been healed, that they approach him and say, you know, you can't carry that thing on the Sabbath, right? And I'm like, you're kidding. I mean, picture that you're driving through your town and you see a guy keel over from a heart attack. So you pull over real quickly and you get out dialing and talking to the 911 people as you go, and you administer CPR until the ambulance gets there, and they get the guy and he's gonna live, and they take him away. And as the sirens fade, the policeman walks up to you and says, you didn't see that yellow curb, buddy? Because you know it means you can't park here. I'm afraid I'm going to have to write you a ticket. You can't carry that bed today, because today is the Sabbath. And the man's answer is to me the most interesting and compelling part of the passage. Well, the guy who made me whole is the same guy who told me to pick up this bed when I left. And when a guy can cure you from a lameness that you have had for 38 years and make your legs strong and put you on your feet and get you walking, and he says to you, take that bed with you, you know what you do? You pick that thing up and you take it with you. 38 years I was lame, and you guys did nothing to make me whole. But he made me whole. So excuse me if I choose to do, I get it, you got rules against me carrying this bed, but he told me to carry it. So if it's all the same to you, I'll just take my bed and be going. Passage continues. The man cannot tell the Jewish authorities exactly who the guy was who healed him and encouraged his reckless Sabbath breaking. Jesus afterwards approaches the man he has healed in the temple and makes himself known to him and encourages him to make his new life a really new life, morally as well as physically, because, friends, there are ultimately worse things that happen to sinners than the loss of the use of your legs. Live a really new life, Jesus says to this man. And then the man runs back to the Jewish authorities. It does not say that they questioned him again, so I get the idea that he went back to them and said, I know who he is now. It's Jesus. Jesus. He's the guy. He's the guy who healed me. I think that in his mind it was, if there's a guy out there who can heal people with a command, then I think the religious leaders ought to know that guy. So he runs and tells them. From the religious leader's point of view, they think to themselves, if there's a guy out there who's encouraging Sabbath breaking, we ought to know that guy. So they approach Jesus, and they are ready to kill him for having encouraged this man to carry his bed on the Sabbath. And Jesus' answer to the authorities is like this. You don't like my attitude about the Sabbath? Well, try this one on for size. I'm the Son of God. And if you read just one verse past where Jim stopped, you see that the leaders took the point. And now they really, really want to see Jesus murdered. But all of that just reinforces and supports for me the part of the passage I find most interesting. The same guy who made me whole told me to carry this bed. So I did. And I'm still going to. It's such a small thing. Such a small, small thing. I have been to the high-end mattress stores. Any of you ever price expensive mattresses these days? You know what they're charging for those things? I have an idea now. I have an idea what they charge for a SleepLogic memory foam temperature-regulating, odor-resistant back-massaging mattresses. I don't think that's what this guy had. I think that his little bed probably consisted of a couple of sticks and some rags and maybe a palm frond or two. I don't think it was anything that he was concerned to keep with him. I think he would have been just as happy to leave it behind. I don't think he was intending to pass it on to his kids. I don't expect that he expected ever to need the thing again. But the fact remained, the guy that made me whole said, pick it up and take it with you. So I did. Let's just check ourselves here. Just on the obvious face of this passage, I could ask you, and I can ask myself an answer, how many of you have been sick and received healing through Jesus Christ? Because I have. That has happened to me. And you come to me and I'll tell you the story. So just on the face of it, there's that. But let me ask you a few other questions. How many of you have been depressed and been lifted up by Jesus Christ? How many of you have been perplexed and God answers in peace because of Jesus Christ? How many of you have been distressed and received calm through Jesus Christ? How many of you have received a blessing in your financial life due to the influence of Jesus Christ? How many of you have a marriage that is better because of the influence of Jesus Christ? Now let me try this, and I want to see every hand up. How many of you were shackled by sin and got set free by Jesus Christ? All right. He's the one who made you whole. What else did he ask you to do? And are you doing it? Or are the instructions given by the one who made you whole just too much trouble? Not worth taking any flack over. And there are some things that he told everybody to do, these universal things that every single believer in Jesus Christ should do. And if you don't know what those things are, you come and see me or see one of the elders, and we'll make sure you know what are the things that every believer in Christ has been asked to do by their Lord who made them. And there may be individual specific things that Jesus asks of you, just you, specifically you. I could point you to people in this congregation who struggled for a while because they didn't immediately do what the Lord required of them. And you know, when they found peace, when they did it, that thing that the one who made them whole told them to do. What did he ask of you? And are you doing it? You know, maybe you have a decision to make about the big universal things or about the specific things. I can only encourage you, whatever it is that he has asked you to do it. It may be a small thing. And what would have been lost if that man had left that bed laying there? Well, maybe to him, nothing. To us, I hope you can see now. I encourage you, whatever it is that he lays on your heart to do, you do it. And if the world gives you any flack, your answer is this: the guy who made me whole is the same guy who told me to do this. And I see that you don't like it, but I'm going to do it just the same for the one who made me whole.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church by visiting our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. That's www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.